pretty good. We clapped at the same time. Hello.
You hesitated a little bit.
I was about to say Everybody Wants to Be a Cat. No, that is my other podcast. Welcome to Murder in the Land of Oz. I'm Jess. And we are your hosts. We're up to our fourth season. Fourth?
Yay. Yes.
We're in Tasmania.
Tasmania. The coldest state.
Which is where Ellen lives.
Yes, I'm very
For now.
For now. One day we will all live in heaven. So yes, this is only my temporary home. Jess is full blown cacking it.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. So it's my turn and I decide, well, do we have any housekeeping? No. Actually, become a Patreon.
Yes, please do. We just posted some fun, zazzy, interesting Patreon content.
Zazzy that you is could the listen right to. Word. It was a friendship quiz. So if you want to get to know Ellen and I more, you can subscribe to our Patreon. And
we also do true crime stuff there as well, not just silly things.
I should also share, we do have merch on TeePublic. We are getting some new shirts made with some funny, zany slogans. So if there's anything that we've said in Mitlu that you think is funny, you should email us at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com and let us know. So far we've got the devil's avocado, what a bunch of noodles, sorry, I'm BZ.
I'm going to buy one of those BZ ones and just like ceremoniously like put it on fire.
Ouch.
No, I won't. I love BZ.
And it's funny because I came up with BZ in the back of an Uber because I was too drunk to spell busy when I was mad about a binman. And then the last one that we have is ghost research. It's not peer reviewed, which is possibly my favorite thing that Ellen has ever said on this podcast.
It's not peer reviewed, but it could be. I'm willing to be your ghost editor. Please email my personal email address if you have any ghost research you'd like me to look at. I will look at it.
Stunning. So, it's my turn tonight. For someone who's never been to Tasmania, this will be interesting. I went deep and dark, mates. Like, deep and bloody fucking dark.
We went full depresso espresso.
Full depresso espresso. Oh, my God. And I am going to be talking to you about the Port Arthur Massacre. Because the world isn't depressing enough.
We just thought we'd make it a little bit worse by reminding everybody of one of the darkest times in Australian history.
Uh-huh. But also one of the most interesting in reflection on what happened with Port Arthur of how our government and laws changed.
One of the only efficient good things the Australian government has ever done.
Yeah. And is also, I'm quite proud of what they did, but we're going to get to that in a minute. Mm. Okay, so let's tell you a little bit about Port Arthur, because before the massacre, it was also it still is quite the tourist destination, but it wasn't known for a massacre beforehand. So Port Arthur was a penal settlement that began its life as a timber station in 1830 and quickly grew in importance within the colonies. Shipbuilding was introduced to a larger scale to Port Arthur as a way of providing selected convicts with a useful skill that they could take with them once they were freed. So basically, when they stopped being a convict, they had a trade. In 1853, the cessation of transportation resulted in fewer transportees arriving at the station. But between 1850 and 1860, there were years of remarkable activity that aimed to make the station economically sustainable. So the Port Arthur story didn't end with the removal of the last convict. Almost immediately, the site was renamed Carnarvon. And during Carnarvon. Carnarvon. That goes to show that I've never been to Tasmania.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. You just sounded wrong.
That kind of sounds better. During the 1880s, the land was parceled up and put to auction. People that were taking up residence on the old site. So Port Arthur Historic Site is a large site holding many great stories. Places like the penitentiary, which was originally constructed as a flour mill in 1843, before it housed hundreds of convicts in dormitories and solitary cells, or the much feared separate prison, where there was like harsh physical punishment, And Punishment of the Mind. Yuck.
Also Mad Ghosts. Please listen to our ghost episode if you want to hear more about the ghosts.
I don't believe in ghosts because otherwise I would never sleep again. But you should go and listen to that episode because it's really fucking funny. Ellen did such a good job.
Also, I believe in ghosts.
All right. So we're going to jump forward to the 7th of May, 1967, when Martin Bryant was born at the Queen Alexandria Hospital in Hobart, Tasmania. He was the first son to Maurice and Carlene Bryant. The family home was in Lena Valley in Tasmania, but Bryant spent much of his childhood at the beach home in Carnarvon Bay. In an interview in 2011, his mum recalls that while he was very young, she would often find Martin's toys broken and said he was annoying and different.
That's rough.
That's a good way to think of your child, isn't it? A psychologist's view was that he would never hold down a job and would aggravate people to such an extent he would always be in trouble. Ooh. There is a beeping noise. Goodbye, Brisbane Valley. You are so noisy. Oh, sorry, Ellen. I got you there.
You got me.
Other sort of like reports on Bryant from when he was a kid was that he pulled a snorkel from another boy while they were diving and once cut down trees on a neighbor's property. Oh, no. He was described by teachers as being distant from reality and unemotional. Same. Sorry. At school, he was disruptive and violent. And he also suffered from severe bullying by other children.
Same.
Yeah, same. He was suspended from Newtown Primary School in 1977. A psychological assessment of him noted of his torturing of animals. Ugh, that's such a red flag. He returned to school the following year and his behavior had improved, but he started teasing younger children. Ugh. He was transferred to a special education school in 1980, where he deteriorated both academically and in behaviour throughout his remaining school years. As an adolescent, he continued to be disturbed and outlined the possibility of him actually having an intellectual disability. He was revealed to be borderline mentally disabled with an IQ of 66, equivalent to that of an 11-year-old. Further testing following his arrest, spoiler alert, he was arrested.
What?
Sorry.
Wait, are you telling me this man committed a crime?
Yeah.
This person who tortured animals as a child grew up to be a criminal?
Yeah.
I'm so shocked. I am.
Whoa, right?
Twists and turns in this episode.
So following his arrest, it indicated a verbal IQ of 64 and a nonverbal reasoning and cognitive functioning of 68, giving him a full scale of 66. When leaving school in 1983, Bryant was assessed for a disability pension by a psychiatrist who wrote that he cannot read or write, does a bit of gardening and watches TV, could be schizophrenic, and parents face a bleak future with him. So he received a disability pension. Yeah. But he also worked as a handyman and a gardener. So, 87. Enter Helen Mary Elizabeth Harvey. She was an heiress to the Tattersalls lottery fortune. So Bryant was looking for new customers for his lawn mowing services. And Helen was living with her mother, Hilza. Hilza. What an interesting name.
The Hilza alive with the sound of music.
Well, hopefully. I hope the Hilza alive with the sound of music. We'll see.
You were not remotely laughing at that joke.
No, because you did the dead opposite about of what laugh. The hell is happening tomorrow night. So Bryant became friends with Helen, and he frequently neglected. She had this massive mansion in Newtown, which was dilapidated. Like, think Grey Gardens.
Mm.
So a lot of money. Well, not that Grey Gardens had a lot of money, but they did at one point have a lot of money, and then the house became dilapidated.
Dilapidated tracks with what I know of Newtown.
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's it like? Tell me.
It's like housing estate-y. You know, like lots of like, I would equate it to like kabulcha or Moray Field or something like that.
I'm also obsessed with how you just said the word kabulcha. Kabulcha.
Kabulcha.
Kabulcha?
I love kabulcha.
Kabulcha.
Everybody knows that I'm the bogan.
So Bryant's, as well as like being a handyman and a gardener, he assisted in feeding the 14 dogs that were living in the house and the 40 cats.
Oh, love this story.
Living inside her garage. What a nightmare. I love cats, but I don't love 40 cats in one garage. That sounds fucked.
10 out of 10 would not pat.
So in June 1990, someone reported Helen Harvey to the health authorities, and medics found both Harvey and her mother in need of urgent hospital treatment. Helen's mother, Hilza Harvey, died several weeks later after this report. So they were ordered to clean up the mansion. So Martin Bryant's father, Maurice, helped in the cleanup, taking long service leave off. This is when Helen Harvey invited Martin Bryant to live with her in the mansion. And they began spending large amounts of money. I have such yucky feelings about this.
This reminds me of Sunset Boulevard, but not fancy.
Yeah. It's very Norma Desmond sort of vibes, isn't it?
Mm.
They started spending a lot of money, which included a purchase of 30 cars in less than 3 years. I mean, one car's enough.
If I could buy 30 cars, I probably would. But also, I would want somebody to check and make sure that I was okay, because it's crazy.
Yeah, that's busy.
I'm not Kylie Jenner.
That's tizzy, in fact, you know?
It's very tizzy.
It's very teasy. So Helen and Martin Bryant began spending most of the day shopping, and they'd have lunch at a local restaurant. So Martin Bryant was then reassessed for his pension, because he was on a disability pension. And it was noted, his father protects him from any occasion which might upset him as he continually threatens violence. Martin tells me he would like to go around shooting people. It would be unsafe to allow Martin out of his parents' control.
Reddest of red flags.
So in 91, as a result of not being allowed to have animals at the house anymore, Helen and Martin moved to a 29-hectare or 72-acre farm called Torresville that she'd purchased. Neighbours recalled that Martin Bryant was always carrying around an air gun and often fired it at tourists if they stopped to buy apples. So people avoided him at all costs. I wonder why.
Yeah.
So I guess, all right. So 20th of October 1992, Helen was killed in a car accident. She had veered to the wrong side of the road and hit an oncoming car directly. And Martin Bryant was actually in the vehicle at the time of the accident and was hospitalized for 7 months with severe neck and back injuries. He was briefly investigated by police as to maybe he played a role in the accident, because he had a known habit of lunging for the steering wheel. And Helen had had three three accidents previously because of Martin doing that.
What?
So, and she told people that she never drove over 60 kilometers an hour. So, suspiciously, Martin Bryant was named as sole beneficiary of Helen's will and came into possession of assets totaling at more than $550,000. Martin, obviously, with his low IQ and big issues and a less than good sense of reality, he didn't have any idea about financial matters. So his mother, Carlene, applied for guardianship over the assets and management under the public trustees. And yeah, this was due to his diminished intellectual capacity.
Mm.
So after Helen's death, Maurice Bryant's father, Martin Bryant's father, looked after the farm where Helen and Martin had moved to. But then Martin returned to the family home to convalesce after being in hospital from the accident.
Mm-hmm.
His father at this time had been prescribed antidepressants and had discreetly transferred his bank account and all the utilities into his wife's name. Yucky, 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 right? Okay,
that
cool.
That seems suspicious.
2 months later, 14th of August, 1993, I would have been just over 2 months old.
I would have been just under 1 month old.
2 months later, a visitor looking for Maurice at the Copping property found a note saying, called the police, that was pinned to the door, and found several thousands of dollars in the car. So the officers saw no reason for criminal intent and sent council members and police to, you know, quell the stress and put forward letters to local...
They saw no reason for... There was a note on the door saying, call the police, and they were like,
No, it doesn't seem that serious.
Like,
that means that they know, like, they didn't think it was a murder.
Oh, okay.
So then police searched the property and they couldn't find Maurice everywhere, and then they sent divers into the dam, like, because there was four dams on the property.
Mm.
And so 2 days later, on the 16th of August, Maurice's body was found in the dam closest to the farmhouse, with one of the diving belts around his neck. So obviously the death was unnatural and it was ruled a suicide.
Suicide when it said, call the police on the door. There was a note saying, call the police.
Yeah, that Martin's dad wrote, as in, go and find my body.
No.
What? That was a suicide note.
Why did he kill himself?
Because we're going to get to that.
Okay, all right, I'm still very suspicious.
So Martin then inherited proceeds of his dad's superannuation fund, which was valued at $250,000. So then Martin sold Copping Farm for $143,000, but kept the Hobart mansion. While living at Copping, the farm, the white overalls he habitually wore were replaced with clothing more in line with Helen's financial status. But now that he was alone, his dress became more bizarre. He often wore a grey linen suit, a cravat, linen lizard skin shoes, and a Panama hat while carrying a briefcase.
Very fancy. A briefcase with just like chocolate wrappers in it.
He often wore an electric blue suit with flared trousers and a ruffled shirt to the restaurant he frequented. The restaurant owner recalled, it was horrible. Everyone was laughing at him, even the customers. I really felt suddenly quite sorry for him. I realized that this guy didn't really have any friends.
Oh, I didn't feel
so with Helen and Martin's father now dead, he became increasingly lonely. From 93 to 95, he visited various overseas countries about 14 times. And it was funny. And there's a document of his travel between that time. And that was a 3-page document of all the places that he visited. Damn. And it was interesting. I was watching this great YouTube series called Murder with Friends. And they discussed the Port Arthur massacre, and we'll put it in the show notes because I think it's a really interesting discussion between two people about the massacre, especially coming from the perspective of Americans looking at this, the reaction that there was after the massacre. And apparently Martin Bryant would fly a lot and would also like go out to restaurants a lot and go shopping a lot because those were his forms of interaction, because people had to interact with him.
Mm.
Like, you know, when I don't really understand this, but like people that like sit next to you on planes, some people feel compelled to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Or even just like you and I have both worked in customer service, people will come and talk to you and you can tell that it's the only social interaction
they have
that
day. Come in and they're like, oh, we have this one lady and every time she comes in, it's like a 40-minute conversation.
Yeah. And because you have like human empathy, you're like, okay,
of course
I'm the only friend that this person has. And then on the other hand, you're like, lady, get a doll. Cat.
So in late 95, Martin became suicidal and he'd had enough, in quotes. He stated, I just felt more people were against me. When I tried to be friendly towards them, they would walk away. He previously had been little more than a social drinker. His alcohol consumption increased, and although he had not consumed any alcohol on the day of the massacre, his consumption had really escalated like 6 months prior. Mm. So his average daily consumption was estimated at half a bottle of Sambuca, and a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream supplemented with port wine and sweet alcoholic drinks. Okay, so we're getting to the day. Sorry, this makes me very, very upset. So the 28th of April, 1996, Martin Bryant awoke at 6 a.m. by his alarm clock. And this was unusual for Martin because, you know, he didn't have a job. He didn't have anywhere to be and he normally didn't set an alarm. He actually had a girlfriend at the time. What? How did this guy pull a girl? I couldn't find any mention of her really before this, but yeah, he had a girlfriend.
Makes me a little depressed.
So according to his girlfriend, at 8 a.m. Martin left the house. Oh, no, at 8 a.m. she left the house to visit her parents. Martin left the house and switched on the burglar alarm, which was registered at 9:47 a.m. He traveled to Fawcett, arriving sometime around 11 a.m., and he continued down to Port Arthur and was seen driving to Seascape. Now, Seascape was a bed and breakfast. And basically what had happened when Martin had inherited the money from Helen Harvey, his father wanted to buy Seascape as an investment property. And there was this whole kerfuffle with the selling of it. And basically Martin's father didn't get to buy Seascape. And it is thought like that was the beginning of Martin's father's, Maurice's, suicide.
Right, okay.
The handling of it and whatever escalated his depression.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So Seascape was owned by David and Nolene Martin, and Martin Bryant described them as like heinous, awful people. I don't know. And so he arrived at Seascape at 11:45. Martin Bryant went inside and fired several shots, then gagged David Martin and stabbed him. Witnesses testify to different numbers of shots fired at this time. It was stated in court that it's believed that this was the time that Bryant killed the Martins, his first two victims. So a couple had actually stopped at Seascape and Martin Bryant had met them outside. And when they asked if they could have a look at the accommodation, like Martin was like really like rude to them and like made this excuse that his parents were away and that his girlfriend was inside, and his demeanor was described as like really weird, and the couple felt uncomfortable and they left at about 12:35 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So then Martin drove to Port Arthur, taking the keys to the Seascape properties after locking the doors. He stopped the car and pulled over because of overheating and actually talked to two people there. He suggested that they come down to Port Arthur Cafe for a coffee later. So he travelled, yeah, right?
Right.
He travelled past the Port Arthur site and headed to Palmer's Lookout Road property, which was owned by the Martins, and he came across Roger Lana, and Roger had met Martin about 15 years previous. Martin had told Roger Lana that he'd been surfing and had bought a property called Fog Lodge and was now looking to buy some cattle. Bryant also made several comments about buying another property next door that was owned by Nolene and David, who he had. They're unsure of like when the Martins were actually killed, like whether or not they were gagged and held, and then because he eventually goes back to Seascape, but it's thought that they were killed in, like
at before the initially, yeah,
yeah. So then around 1:10. Martin enters the toll booth at the entrance of Port Arthur. He paid the entry fee and proceeded to park near the Broad Arrow Cafe, which is near the water's edge. The security manager told him to park with the other cars because the area was reserved. There was an area reserved for camper vans and the car park was going to be very, very busy that day. So Martin like moved his car to another area and sat in his car for a few minutes. He then moved his car again back near the water outside the cafe, and the security manager saw him again, and this time he was carrying like a large sport bag and a video camera. Martin then went into the cafe, purchased a meal, which he ate on the deck outside. He attempted to start conversations with people, and basically was remarking that there weren't a lot of white people around and that there wasn't as many Japanese tourists around as normal. He appeared nervous and was quite regularly like looking back to the car park and looking inside to the cafe. So Martin then finished his meal. He walked into the cafe to return his tray, assisted by some people that actually opened the door for him. He then put his bag down on the table and pulled out his AR-15 carbine gun and within a scope, like a 30 round magazine, which is a bunch of bullets. The bag also contained other things like a knife that Martin had used to stab David Martin. So the cafe was really, really small and the tables were really close together and it was really, really busy that day because there were a lot of people that were waiting to get on the ferry.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened next is really, 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 really what happened next is basically it happened really quickly. So he took aim from his hip and pointed the rifle at Mo Yi and William and Su Ling Chung, who were visiting from Malaysia, and they were actually seated at the table beside Martin Bryant. He shot them at close range, killing both of them instantly. Bryan then fired a shot at Mick Sargent, grazing his scalp and knocking him to the floor. He fired a fourth shot that killed Sargent's girlfriend, 21-year-old Kate Elizabeth Scott, and hit her at the back of the head. 28-year-old New Zealand winemaker Jason Winter had been helping in the cafe as Bryan turned to Winter's wife, Joanne, and their 15-month-old son, Mitchell. Winter threw a serving tray at Martin in an attempt to distract him. Joanne Winter's father pushed his daughter and grandson to the floor and pushed them under the table. 44-year-old Anthony Nightingale stood up after the sound of the first shots but had no time to move. Nightingale yelled, "No, not here," as Martin pointed his weapon at him. As Nightingale leaned forward, he was fatally shot through the neck and the spine. The next table held a group of 10 friends. I'm so sorry. This is just going to...
This is a lot.
This is a lot. Held a group of 10 friends, but some had just left the table to return their meal trays and visit the gift shop. Bryant fired one shot that killed Vincent Sharp, who was 68. The second hit Walter Bennett, who was 66, which passed through his body and struck Raymond John Sharp, 67, Kevin Sharp's brother, and killed both of them. The three had their backs towards Bryant and were unaware of what was happening. They at first believed someone was letting off a firecracker. One of them actually made a comment, "That's not funny," after hearing the first few shots, not realizing that they were real.
Oh my God.
All the shots were horrible. Close range. With a gun that was inches away from the back of their heads, Gerald Broom, Gay Fiddler, and her husband John were all struck by bullet fragments, but they all survived. Martin then turned towards Tony and Sarah Kiston and Andrew Mills. Both of the men stood up at the noise of the initial shots but had no time to move away. Andrew Mills was shot in the head. Tony Kiston was also shot from about 2 meters away, also in the head, but had managed to push his wife away prior to being shot. Sarah Kiston was apparently not seen by Bryant and she was under the table by that time. Thelma Walker and Pamela Law were injured by fragments before being dragged to the ground by their friend Peter Crosswell as the three sheltered underneath a table. He was also injured by fragments at this time was Patricia Baker. So because this was an automatic rifle, like this is described as happening between 90 and 120 seconds. Like that is how quick.
What?
Yeah, that is how quick it happens because of...
how quick that the gun can work.
Yeah. So it was only after this that the majority of people began to realize what was happening and that the shots weren't coming from a reenactment because people thought it was like to do with the show, mm-hmm. the sound of it. There was a lot of confusion and people didn't know what to do, obviously. And Bryant was actually standing at the main exit. So Martin Bryant then moved a few metres and began shooting at a table where Graham Collier and Carolyn Lawton and Carolyn's daughter Sarah were seated. Collier was severely injured in the jaw, nearly choking to death on his own blood. Sarah Lawton ran towards her mother who had been moving between tables. Carolyn Lawton threw herself on top of her daughter. Bryant shot through Carolyn in the back. Her eardrum was ruptured by the muzzle blast from the gun going off beside her ear. She actually survived her injuries but learned after surgery that despite her efforts to save her daughter had been fatally shot in the head. I'm so sorry. Oh, why no. the fuck did I pick this? Why the fuck did I pick
oh,
this?
Oh, no.
I'm so sorry.
That's bad.
Bryant then pivoted around and shot at Mervyn Howard, who was seated. The bullet passed through him through a window of the cafe and hit a table on the outside balcony. Martin Bryant quickly followed up with a shot to the neck of Mervyn Howard's wife, Mary Howard. Martin Bryant leaned over a vacant baby stroller and pointed the gun at her head and shot her a second time. So Mervyn and Mary Howard both died of their injuries because they, yeah. Martin Bryant was near the exit, preventing others from attempting to run past him and escape. Martin moved across the cafe towards the gift shop area. There was an exit door through the display area to move to the outside balcony, but it was locked up and couldn't be opened with a key. As Martin moved, Robert Elliott stood up. He was shot in the arm and head, left slumping against the fireplace, but he was alive. So, yeah, all of these events from the first... No, I fibbed. So, from the first events of those, the Malaysian couple, to the 12 people who were killed and 10 more wounded, that was between 15 and 30 seconds.
No, my brain can't handle that. My brain can't make that work.
Okay. So he's leaving the cafe and he moved towards the gift shop area. I want to preface that this timeline I've gotten from Wikipedia, there was a really detailed timeline on Wikipedia of Martin Bryant's movement. So this is where I've gotten this from.
It's not that unreputable. We can use Wikipedia.
No. But I just wanted to preface, like, this is where I got it from. So Martin then moved to the gift area, giving many people time to hide under tables or behind shop displays. He fatally shot the two local women who worked in the gift shop, 17-year-old Nicole Burgess in the head and 26-year-old Elizabeth Howard in the arm and the chest. Coralie Lever and Vera J. Jari had hid behind the Hessian screen with other people. Coralie's husband, Dennis, was fatally shot in the head. Pauline Masters, Vera Jari's husband, Ron Jari, Peter and Carolyn Nash had attempted to escape through the locked door but couldn't. Peter Nash lay down on top of his wife to hide her from Martin Bryant. Bryant moved into the gift shop area where several people were trapped with nowhere to go and people were crouched in corners just doing whatever they could to keep themselves hidden. Gwen Neander tried to make it to the door, but she was shot in the head and killed. Martin Bryant then saw movement in the cafe and moved near the front door. He shot at a table and hit Peter Crosswell, who I mentioned before, who was hiding under it. And Jason Winter was hiding in the gift shop, thought that Bryant had left and made a comment about, and made a comment basically to the people around him, like, don't move out in the open. Martin Bryant saw him. Jason Winter said no, just prior to being shot with a bullet hitting him in his neck, hand and chest. A second shot to the head proved fatal to Jason Winter.
Oh, no.
Fragments from these shots struck American tourist Dennis Olson, who had been hiding with his wife Mary, and Jason Winter. Dennis Olson suffered fragment injuries to his hand, scalp, eye and chest, but he survived. It's not clear what happened next, though at some point Martin reloaded his weapon. He walked back to the cafe and then returned to the gift shop, this time looking down to another corner of the shop where he found several people hiding. He walked up to them and shot Ronald Jarry through the neck, then Peter Nash and Pauline Masters, killing all three of them. He didn't see Carolyn Nash, who was lying under her husband. Bryant aimed his gun at an unidentified man, but the rifle's magazine was empty. Bryant quickly then moved to the gift shop counter where he reloaded his rifle, leaving an empty magazine on the counter, and left the building. So at count, Bryant has killed 22 people and injured 12.
Fucking hell.
Okay. So during the cafe shooting, some of the staff members had been able to escape through the kitchen and alerted people outside. There were a number of coaches outside with lines of people. Many of them began to hide in the buses or in nearby buildings. Other people didn't really understand, or they were unsure where to go because they still thought that there was some sort of historical reenactment happening on, like happening. And because this was happening in such a short
span of time,
it's very easy to understand why people were confused. And so Ashley John Law, who was a site employee, was moving people away from the cafe and into an information centre when Martin fired at him from 50 to 100, like between 50 and 100 metres away. Luckily, Ashley Law, the bullets missed them at this point, and they hit some trees nearby. Then Martin moved towards the coaches. One of the coach drivers, Royce Thompson, was shot in the back as he was moving along the passenger side of the coach. He fell to the ground but was able to crawl and then roll under the bus to safety, but he later passed away of his wounds. Bridget Cook, who was trying to guide a number of people down between the buses and along the jetty area, Martin Bryant then moved to the front of this bus and walked across to the next coach. People had begun to quickly move from the coach towards the back end, and in an attempt to seek cover, Martin Bryant walked around and he saw a number of people scrambling to hide, and he shot at them. Bridget Cook was shot in the right thigh, causing the bone to fragment, the bullet lodging in her leg. The coach driver, Ian McCulley, was hit by fragments of Miss Cook's bone. But both were able to survive and escape. So Martin Bryant then quickly moved around to another coach and began firing at another group of people. Winifred Applin was running to get cover behind one of the coaches and was fatally shot in the side. Another bullet grazed Yvonne Lockley's cheek, but she was able to enter one of the coaches and hide and survived. People then began moving away from the car park towards the jetty, but someone shouted that Martin was heading that way, so they tried to double back around the coaches to where Bridget Cook had been shot. But of course, Martin Bryant doubled back to where Janet and Neville Quinn, who actually owned the wildlife park, who owned a wildlife park on the east side of Tasmania, and they were beginning to move towards Mason Cove and away from the buses. Martin Bryant shot Janet Quinn in the back, where she fell, unable to move, near Royce Thompson. Bryant then continued along the car park as people tried to escape along the shore. Doug Hutchinson was attempting to get into the coach, where he was shot in the arm. He quickly ran around to the front of the coach and along the shore to the jetty, and he hid there. Martin Bryant then went to his vehicle, which was just past the coaches, and changed weapons to a self-loading rifle. He fired at Denise Cromer, who was near the penitentiary ruins. Gravel actually flew up in front of her as the bullets hit the ground. Bryant then got in his car and sat there for a few minutes before getting out again and going back to the coaches. Some people were taking cover behind cars in the car park, but because of the elevation, Bryant could see them, and the cars didn't provide much cover. When they realised that Martin Bryant had seen them, they ran into the bush. He fired several shots. At least one hit a tree, which someone was taking cover behind, but no one was hit. Martin Bryant then moved back to the buses, where Janet Quinn lay injured from her earlier shot. Bryant then shot her in the back, then left. She later died from her wounds.
Oh, fuck.
Bryant then went onto one of the coaches and fired and shot at Elva Gaylard, who was hiding inside, hitting her in the arm and chest and killing her. At an adjacent coach, Gordon Francis saw what happened and moved to the aisle to try and shut the door of the coach he was on. He was seen by Martin Bryant and was shot from the opposite coach. He survived but needed four major operations. Neville Quinn, husband of Janet Quinn, who
died,
was shot. had escaped to the jetty area but returned to look for his wife. Oh. He had been forced to leave her earlier after Martin Bryant had shot her. Bryant then exited the coach, and spotting Quinn, chased him around the coaches. Bryant fired at him at least twice before Quinn ran onto a coach. Martin Bryant entered the coach and pointed the gun at Neville Quinn's face, saying, "No one gets away from me." Mr. Quinn ducked when he realized Martin Bryant was about to pull the trigger. The bullet missed his head but hit his neck, momentarily paralyzing him. After Bryant left, Quinn managed to find his wife, although she later died in his arms.
Oh, fucking
Neville Quinn was eventually taken away by helicopter and survived. Bryant fired at James Belasco, a US citizen hitting a nearby car. Belasco had been attempting to film the shooter. Many people unable to use their parked cars were hiding or running along the Jetty Road and didn't know where Bryant was because the gunfire was extremely loud and difficult to pinpoint. So at this point, he's killed 26 people and he's injured 18.
Please tell me there's not much more because I'm going to cry. Oh, bad face. There's a lot more.
Martin Bryant then got back into his car and left the car park. Witnesses said he was sounding the horn and waving as he drove past. Martin Bryant then drove along Jetty Road towards the toll booth where a number of people were running away. Bryant passed at least two people.
Oh, no.
Ahead of him was Nanette McCack and her children, Madeline, who was 3, and Alana, who was 6. Nanette was carrying Madeline and Alana was running slightly ahead. By this point, they had run approximately 600 metres from the car park. Bryant opened his door and slowed down. McCack moved towards the car, thinking that he was offering them help in escaping. Several more people witnessed this from further down the road. Someone recognised him as the gunman and yelled out, "It's him." Bryant stepped out of the car, put his hands on Nanette McCack's shoulder and told her to get on her knees. She did so, saying, "Please don't hurt my babies." Bryant shot her in the temple, killing her. Next, he shot at Madeline, which hit her in the shoulder, and then he shot her fatally in the chest. Bryan shot at Alana and she ran behind a tree. He then walked up and pressed the barrel of the gun into her cheek and fired and killed her instantly.
You've got to be fucking kidding me.
Martin Bryant fired at some people that were hiding in a bush but missed them. Having seen the murders of the children, some people further up the road began running. They told drivers of cars coming down the road to go back. The people thought Martin Bryant might head up the road, so instead they proceeded on foot down the dirt side road and hid in the bush. The cars reversed up the road to the toll booth. Bryant drove up to the toll booth where there were several vehicles and blocked a 1980 BMW owned by Mary Rose Nixon. Inside were Nixon, driver Russell James Pollard, and passengers Helene and Robert Graham Salzman. An argument with Robert Salzman ensued and Bryant took out his rifle and shot Salzman at point-blank range, killing him. Pollard emerged from the BMW and walked towards Bryant, who was then shot in the chest and was killed. More cars then arrived, but seeing this, the drivers were quickly able to reverse back up the road. Bryant then moved to the BMW and pulled Nixon and Helene Salzman from the car and shot them dead, dragging their bodies onto the road. Bryant transferred ammunition, handcuffs, the AR-15 rifle, and a fuel container to the BMW. Mary Nixon, Russell Pollard, Helene Salzman, and Robert Salzman are the people Bryant was charged with killing at the toll booth. Another car then came towards the toll booth and Bryant shot at it. The driver, Graham Sutherland, was hit with glass. A second bullet hit the driver's door. Sutherland quickly reversed back up the road and left. Bryant then got into the BMW, leaving his Volvo, including his shotgun and hundreds of rounds of ammunition. So at this point, Martin Bryant has killed 33 people and injured 19. Okay. Graham Sutherland, who had just been shot at in his car, reversed back up the road and drove to the service station close by where he tried to inform people what was happening. Martin Bryant drove up to the service station and cut off a white Toyota Corolla that was attempting to exit onto the highway. Glenn Piers was driving with his girlfriend Zoe Hall in the passenger seat. Bryant then quickly exited the car with his rifle in hand and tried to pull Hall from the car. Piers got out of the car and approached Bryant. Bryant pointed the gun at Glenn Piers and pushed him backwards, eventually directing him into the now open boot of the BMW, locking Piers inside of it. Moved back to the passenger side of the Corolla as Zoe Hall attempted to climb over to the driver's seat. Bryant raised his rifle and fired 3 shots, killing her. Many people around the service station witnessed this and ran to hide in nearby bushland. The service station attendant told everyone to lie down and he locked the main doors. He grabbed his rifle, but by the time he could retrieve some ammunition and load his gun, Martin Bryant had left in the BMW. A police officer arrived several minutes later and then set out in pursuit of Martin Bryant. Zoe Hall was the 34th victim killed. As Martin Bryant drove down towards Seascape, he shot at a red Ford Falcon coming the other way, smashing its front windscreen. Upon arriving at Seascape, he got out of the car a Holden Frontera four-wheel drive, then approached Seascape along the road. Those in the vehicle saw Bryant with his gun, believed him to be rabbit hunting and actually slowed down as they passed him. Bryant fired into the car. The first bullet hit the bonnet and broke the throttle cable. He fired at least twice more into the car as it passed, breaking the windows. One of the bullets hit the driver, Linda White, in the arm. The car was going downhill, so it was able to roll down the road out of sight and around the corner despite its broken throttle cable. White swapped seats with her boyfriend, Michael Wanders, who attempted to drive the car but was unable to because of the broken throttle cable. Another vehicle then drove down the road carrying four people. It was not until they were almost adjacent to Bryant that they realized he was carrying a gun. Bryant shot at the car, smashing the windscreen. Douglas Horner was wounded by the pieces of the windscreen. The car proceeded ahead where White and Wanders tried to get in, but Horner didn't realize the situation and drove on. When they saw that White had been shot, they came back and picked them up. Both parties then continued down to a local establishment called the Fox and Hound, where they called police. Yet another car drove past and Bryant shot at it, hitting the passenger, Susan Williams, in the hand. The driver, Simon Williams, was struck by fragments. The driver of another approaching vehicle saw this and reversed back up the road. Bryant also fired at this car, hitting it, but not injuring anyone. Bryant then gone back into the BMW and drove down to the Seascape driveway to the house where the Martins, his first victims, lay dead. Sometime after he stopped, Bryant removed Pierce from the boot and handcuffed him to a stair rail within the house. At some point, he also set the BMW on fire. He is believed to have arrived back at the house at around 2 p.m. So he went out the 29th of April 1996, so the next day. Bryant was captured the following morning when a fire started in the guest house, presumably set by Bryant. Bryant taunted the police to come and get him, but the police, believing the hostages were already dead, decided that the fire would eventually bring Bryant out. Bryant eventually ran out of the house with his clothes on fire, suffering burns to his back and bum. He was arrested and taken to hospital for treatment.
What's the point?
It was discovered that Glenn Pierce had been shot during or before the standoff and had died before the fire. The remains of the Martins were also found. It was determined that they had been shot and that Nolene Martin had suffered blunt force trauma. They both died before the fire. Witness accounts of the gunfire, as presented to the Supreme Court of Tasmania, place the time of death of David and Nolene Martin at approximately noon on the 28th of April, so the day before. One weapon was found burnt in the house and the other on the roof of the adjacent building where police believed they had seen Martin the night before. Both weapons had suffered from massive chamber blast pressure, possibly from the heat of the house fire. The Port Arthur tourist site reopened a few weeks later, and since then a new restaurant has been built. The former Broad Arrow Cafe structure is now a place for quiet reflection with a monument and a memorial garden dedicated to the site in April 2000. The Australian Journal of Emergency Management published several research articles on the response and the ongoing process of recovery, including an article about caring for the social workers, which was working with residents. A substantial community fund was given to the victims of the Port Arthur massacre. The murder of Nanette McCack and her daughters Alana and Madeline inspired Dr. Phil West of Melbourne, who had two girls similar in age to the murdered children, to set up a foundation in their memory. The Alana and Madeline Foundation supports child victims of violence and runs a national anti-bullying program. It was launched by the Prime Minister on the first anniversary of the massacre. The massacre at Port Arthur created a kinship with the Scottish town of Dunblane, which had suffered a similar event, the Dunblane school massacre, only weeks previously. And a lot of people think that
he was like inspired Martin by Bryant. It.
Yeah. Paul Mullen, a forensic psychiatrist, his extensive involvement following the string of massacres in Australia and New Zealand, attributes both the Port Arthur massacre and some of the earlier massacres to the copycat effect. In this theory, the saturation of media coverage provides both instruction and perverse incentives for dysfunctional individuals to imitate previous crimes, which I think is
possible.
The coverage of the Dunblane massacre basically caught the attention of Martin Bryant and is thought to have been the trigger.
Right.
Okay. Following Port Arthur, the Prime Minister at the time, his name was John Howard, led the development of the strict gun control laws within Australia and formulated the National Firearms Program Implementation Act of 1996, which basically restricted the private ownership of semi-automatic rifles, semi-automatic shotguns and pump-action shotguns. as well as introducing firearm licenses. It was implemented with the bipartisan support by the Commonwealth, states and territories. so sorry.
We're struggling. We're on Struggle Street.
So as well as them developing, the federal government coordination with all of the states and territories of Australia restricted legal ownership and the use of self-loading rifles, self-loading shotguns and tightened controls. The government also initiated a mandatory buyback scheme with the owners paid according to the table of valuations. Some 643,000 firearms were handed in at a cost of $350 million, which was funded by a temporary increase in the Medicare levy, which was raised to $500
million.
Mm. Media activists, politicians and some family members of victims, notably Walter McCack, who had lost his wife and two children, spoke out in favour of the changes. A lot of discussion has occurred into the level of Martin Bryant's general health. Of course, he had a low IQ, and at the time, the offences... I can't read my writing. No, never mind. Okay. So, basically, Martin Bryant... Mm. Ooh, hello. Someone messaged me, probably to be like, are you crying? I feel like you're crying. It's generally accepted that he had a subnormal IQ, and at the time of the offences was in receipt of a disability support pension on the basis of being mentally handicapped. The media also detailed his odd behaviour as a child. However, he was able to drive a car and obtain a gun, which is fucked.
Very fucked.
Even though he didn't have a gun licence or a driver's licence, which is cooked. So Martin, at 28, pleaded guilty to have carried out the shootings and was given 35 life sentences without the possibility of parole. And as of 2015, and as of now, he is at Risdon Prison.
Good. Hopefully having a very bad time.
So, obviously, he was burnt after the burning at Seascape, and he was held at the Royal Albert Hospital under heavy police guard.
Mm-hmm.
Police, according to a police officer that was tasked with guarding him, at least two would-be vigilantes made unsuccessful applications to hospital security staff in order to exact revenge. In his police interview, Bryant admitted to having carjacked the BMW but claimed it only had three occupants and denied shooting any person. He also claimed that he did not take the BMW from the vicinity of the toll booth and that his hostage was taken from the BMW. He said he thought the man he took hostage must have died in the boot when the car exploded. He did not distinguish between the car fire and the house fire that happened later. So initially, Martin Bryant pled not guilty to the 35 murders and did not provide a confession. However, he changed his plea for the court hearing on the 19th of November 1996. He was found guilty. So he changed his plea to guilty, basically, and he was found guilty of all charges. And I think the thing that like sets off a lot of conspiracy theories on this case is that all of the evidence for this case is actually sealed.
That's interesting.
So,
It's not uncommon in Australia, though. We don't automatically release all of our, you know, trial transcripts and things like that, especially if there are children involved.
Yeah. So on the 22nd of November 1996, Martin Bryant was sentenced to 35 life sentences, as I've said before, for each count of murder, and sentenced to 25 years for the remaining 36 charges on the five other offences, 20 attempted murders, three counts of infliction of grievous bodily harm, the infliction of wounds upon a further eight persons, four counts of aggravated assault, and one count of unlawfully setting fire to property. All sentences are to be served concurrently in Hobart's Risdon Prison, where he remains in solitary confinement and is not permitted any visitors other than his immediate family, and the only person that goes and visits him is his mother. His prison papers indicate that he's never to be released and continues to serve his term. This is actually quite rare in Australia, where the majority of murder sentences allow for parole.
The possibility of parole
after a long prison term. So yeah, the records are sealed on Port Arthur. And the thing that's really fucked is the amount of conspiracy theories that there are about Port Arthur, that basically, previous to Port Arthur, Australia was... our government was trying to make heavier restrictions on gun laws. And some people like to think that
it was orchestrated so that the government would have an excuse.
Yeah.
Why is like the Venn diagram of like
a fucking insult to the victims, to the eyewitnesses, to the families that saw him there that day,
yeah,
and know that it was Martin Bryant, and to say that he didn't do it, because his mother has even come out recently and said, no, he didn't do it. There's no evidence of him being at Port Arthur. There is evidence. It's just sealed.
Also, like, you know,
eyewitnesses saw him do it. Evidence. Yeah.
The police who saw him run out of a burning building on fire.
Pauline Hanson has even recently come out and said something about Port Arthur, even though she has no.
Yeah, she said that when One Nation, which is like our incredibly, incredibly racist political party here in Australia, because you got to have one, they were busted from saying that they were going to receive donations from the NRA, so the American National Rifle Associations, and they were filmed undercover by a reporter, and she said that there was evidence to say that Port Arthur was a setup, which is just like in a lifetime of saying incredibly racist, incredibly stupid, incredibly offensive, incredibly idiotic things, that's like top shelf.
Yeah
So he did it. There's no question that he did it. I don't understand why there is such a crossover of like gun nuts and conspiracy theorists. I don't understand why people quite rationally wanting to limit another person's ability to kill somebody is considered to be like insane. I don't understand why it has to be conspiracy to not want people to be able to murder other people. I've never understood that point of view. And I also don't understand how gun conspiracy people, you know, they say Sandy Hook's a conspiracy. They say Parkland shooting is a conspiracy. How can they all be conspiracies? None of them are conspiracies.
Yeah, so Port Arthur is one of the biggest mass shootings that's ever happened up until, I think, Sandy Hook.
Mm.
And I think, obviously, our government works a lot differently than the American government, because they have this, like, the Senate is a lot more, you know.
Because our public officials, by and large, aren't being bribed by the NRA.
Yeah. And, you know, at the very least, there should be mandatory checks, mental health checks on people that are wanting to buy guns. I just think that's common sense.
I just think that, you know, I know we have a lot of listeners from America, and I know they have a lot of different opinions about gun ownership and stuff like that, but I just don't think a human being should be allowed to have a weapon that can kill another human being. I don't think
a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old's life is worth more than your right to have a gun.
Yeah, exactly. So I am very, very anti-gun ownership. I don't care what your reasons are. Oh, I have to shoot rabbits because they come onto my farm. Okay, maybe. Like, maybe I will give you a pass for that.
But you don't need an AR-15 nobody
needs,
for that.
Nobody needs a weapon that can kill 30 nobody people in 30 seconds. Nobody needs military-grade
weapons.
No. So this episode was one of the worst episodes in terms of sadness levels. Great in terms of, like, research, but I've never felt so dead inside.
So I got a lot of the timeline was from Wikipedia. Like, thank you so much.
Shout out to Wikipedia. Sponsor
Murder
us.
With Friends, which was a great, like, just a, you know, it was really great to watch and get some opinion, especially from an American, like, point of view on the Port Arthur massacre. Horrific.
Horrific.
Horrific, horrific, horrific. And I just think they mentioned this in Murder with Friends, and I've never really thought about it like this. Like, how insulting to the people that were there and the people that saw him to say that he didn't do it.
Yeah, so insulting. And I think like, that, too, about Sandy Hook.
I don't think you're going to forget the guy that was pointing a gun around.
No. No.
Yeah, absolutely horrific. One of the worst things I will ever read about ever, yeah, and I never wish to discuss this ever again.
I didn't know, like, 95% of what you spoke about. I mean, I think in Australia, like, we do hear about the Port Arthur massacre, like, growing up, and I've been to Port Arthur, and I've been to the monument that they have there, and, I mean, I was 15 and not necessarily the most woke, but I was like, oh, sad, a bunch of people died, and didn't really know much more about it beyond that, and I am sad, I guess, that it has taken me so long to know all of. I'd never understood his motivations or anything about his life. I just knew that he was the guy that caused gun control to happen in Australia. So
I just also want to point out, so yeah, the oldest people that were killed in Port Arthur was 72. The youngest was 3.
That's insane.
There are 3 columns of names. Winifred Joyce Applin, Walter John Bennett. I'm going to name them because Nicole Louise Burgess, Sue Leng Chung, Elva Rhonda Gaylard, Zoe Ann Hall, Elizabeth Jane Howard, Mary Elizabeth Howard, Mervyn John Howard, Ronald Noel Jarry, Tony Crick Kisten, Leslie Dennis Lever, Sarah Kate Lawton, David Martin, Nolene Joyce Martin, Pauline Masters, Alana Louise McCack, Madeline Grace McCack, Nanette Patricia McCack, Andrew Bruce Mills, Peter Brenton Nash, Gwenda Joan Neander, William Zeng, Anthony Nightingale, Mary Rose Nixon, Glenn Roy Piers, Russell James Pollard, Janet Kathleen Quinn, Helene Maria Salzman, Robert Graham Salzman, Kate Elizabeth Scott, Kevin Vincent Sharp, Raymond John Sharp, Royce William Thompson, and Jason Bernard Winter. Those are their names. Like, those are the fatalities of Port Arthur. Like, that is the most ridiculous amount of
That's insane.
Names I've ever seen in my entire life.
And that's something that we have to keep in mind during these, like, mass shootings, that it's not just a number. It's not, like, a kill count. No, it's individuals.
And it's exactly right. And it's exactly right what they said. Like, the saturation of mass killings and that inspiring people to do this, that we have to stop talking about these fuckwits. And I'm really depressed now.
I think that we can look to the recent shooting in New Zealand for some optimism in terms of coverage of these things. The shooter hasn't been named in any, you know, mass publications. Jacinda Ardern, the world's best political leader, has handled it like no leader has before. And just like the upswell and community feeling and the real feeling that, you know, something happened like this and it was never going to happen again, hopefully is something that the world can look at in terms of how to handle the next mass shooting that will happen in America, because it will happen and it's probably going to happen tomorrow at this rate. But yeah, not publicizing it, not glorifying it, not giving these people anything to be inspired by. I mean, so many articles, ever since like Columbine, so many articles and research has been done saying that mass shootings should not be sensationalized, and still every time they happen, they are sensationalized in the media. So hopefully with everything that's happened in New Zealand, that will be, you know, the catalyst for change. And hopefully nothing like this ever does happen again, because it's happened too many times and it shouldn't. Great work, Jess. Yeah. We're all going to sit in a dark room for 20 minutes and cry.
No, we're going to do more Patreon content.
Yay. If you want to listen to us completely soul deadened after this episode on Patreon, become a Patreon.
Also, I need more help on cases to do in Tasmania. So if you have any Tasmanian cases, murder us. Email us at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com.
You can murder us too.
Find us on Instagram at murderintheLandOfOz. Find us on Facebook at murderintheLandOfOz. Rate and review. Tell me how shit I am. I don't care. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Goodbye.
Hey guys, it's Julie.
And KB.
From Elvis Lives, a conspiracy theory podcast.
What do we talk about, Julie?
Conspiracies.
No way.
What kind do we talk about?
Celebrities.
Government.
Time travel.
Ooh. Tune in every Monday.
What day?
Monday.
What was it?
Monday.
Oh, Monday.
Monday for your fill of conspiracy theories.